Bill. This is Arnold from Cows Radio in California.
Oh, good to talk to you.
Well, great to speak to you. Well, thanks so much for the interview. I appreciate it. How's it in? Are you in New York today?
Manhattan, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's nice. It's kind of very crisp and clear. Kind of colder than usual, but it's nice.
Oh, good. Now, being in New York, have you checked out the Occupy Wall Street happening?
Yeah, I was down there once. I should go more often because, you know, it's about a 15-minute walk from my office, but I seem to always mean to get there, and I don't. But it's pretty impressive. I've been there, you know.
You recently did the book Prophets of War. Earlier this year it came out, didn't it?
Yes, it came out in January.
What's behind, obviously, Lockheed Martin and the whole military-industrial complex? Now, how did you get into this line of work?
Well, I majored in philosophy in college, so I didn't have, like, an obvious career path. I mean, you know, I thought I was going to become a philosophy teacher. So, but I got a job at a small think tank called the Council on Economic Priorities, which dealt with corporate social responsibility. And so when I got there, I did a lot of work on defense contractors and arms training companies and so forth. And it all sort of grew out of my political work in college, which was in the anti-apartheid movement. I did a lot of writing about violations of the embargo there and, you know, how corporations operated to get around it.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was really kind of almost not my schoolwork so much, but my political work that sort of ended me up doing what I'm doing now.
Oh, excellent. And now, right now, you're at the Center for International Policy. Could you tell us what that is and what you do there?
Yes. We're a kind of small, you know, 28-person think tank that works on issues ranging from preventing deforestation in the developing world to financial integrity, trying to keep people from looting third world countries by using the banking system. I work on disarmament and military budget and arms trade issues. And the basic thrust of the center is to try to promote a U.S. foreign policy that's less militarized and is more respectful of human rights.
Obviously, right now, we seem to be at a momentous moment in history in a number of different ways. And obviously, the military is in the middle of it all. With politics. Now, we have this deadline coming up November 23rd. Could you maybe give us some background on the super committee and the whole November 23rd deadline?
In the context of the fight over the debt ceiling in the summer, the Congress created this committee of 12 members who were supposed to come up with a 10-year deficit reduction plan of at least $1 trillion. And if the stipulation is if they can't do that, there would be across-the-board cuts of $1.2 trillion in the whole budget, the discretionary budget, which would mean about $600 billion from the Pentagon over 10 years. So the arms lobby is very concerned about that, and they've been kind of crying poverty, if you can believe that, and also talking about all kinds of devastation to the economy if they don't get exactly the amount of money they're getting now and so forth. So they've been putting pressure on the super committee, both directly through their lobbyists, but also by making a big noise publicly, particularly about their claims about what it will do to jobs if there's significant cuts in the Pentagon budget. So, you know, the November 23rd deadline will probably just be another milestone. You know, this thing's going to be slugged out over the next year leading up to the elections for president. So, but the super committee will sort of set the tone for a lot of that discussion.
Now, it seemed just reading the paper, John Boehner saying, you know, and even Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, is saying that it's already been cut enough in the last go rounds. How do you see that?
Well, it's a fascinating exercise in propaganda. I mean, at the time of the debt ceiling deal, the administration said, well, you know, we'll reduce spending by $350 billion over 10 years. That's not really a reduction. What they're saying is the Pentagon wants huge increases So we'll give them slightly smaller increases, and the difference will be $350 billion. Mm. But none of that has happened yet. You know, these are things that they are proposing to do over a 10-year period. But what the Pentagon and the industry in their PR have been saying is, well, we've already been cut to the bone, when, in fact, all these cuts are, at the moment, is rhetoric. So they've kind of, manipulated the language, to put it mildly, to make it seem like things have already happened, when, in fact, other than a little bit of tinkering because of the various budget ceiling and deficit fights, the military budget is still at its highest level since World War II, so there really hasn't been any cutting, despite the rhetoric, which is unfortunately getting quite a bit of play in the press.
Yeah, I wonder why. And how much is the military budget? What really are we spending when you throw in all the different pockets together?
Well, just the Pentagon plus the wars is a little over $700 billion a year. Hmm. But then there's military-related things, like the Homeland Security Department, which is quite substantial. Hmm. There's, veterans' costs, which obviously we must pay to take care of our veterans, but they're generated from military activity, from war. So in a sense, they're a cost and consequence of going to war. Mm-hmm. And then there's military aid, which isn't usually counted. There's the issue of that, our debt is much higher because of spending on the Pentagon. So there's been people, a colleague of mine, Christopher Hellman, who's at a place called the National Priorities Project, sort of looked at all these different pieces in the intelligence community, which is about $80 billion a year. And he came up with a figure of about $1.2 trillion. So almost twice the official number if you look at all the military-related items that are not under the umbrella of the Pentagon.
Right. Wow. That's quite a little 10% markup there, isn't it?
And, of course, in terms of the deficit reduction, if you looked at the full scope of military spending, there's quite a bit of room there to make some savings, so you wouldn't have to cut, Medicare or other, kind of basic programs. If they're going to have a deficit reduction plan, mm-hmm. there's a lot of military-related money that they could go after, mm-hmm. more than just what's in the Pentagon budget, if they chose to do so.
So it just depends what pocket they pull it out of and where they put it into, basically.
Exactly. And, it's complicated enough that it gives them a great advantage because most people can't be informed well enough to hold them accountable when they make these kind of, engage in these kind of budget shell games that they often do.
Right, so Leon Panetta's quote of a doomsday mechanism, is that really just another Y2K thing?
Yes, that. it's really a rhetorical flourish that he came up with, which unfortunately seems to have some staying power. It's quoted quite a bit. And it's about this triggering mechanism, if the super committee fails, that could result in the $600 billion in reductions in the Pentagon spending plans. But there's a couple things about that. First of all, even if that happened, we would still end up spending about what we spent in 2007 on the Pentagon, which was, at that time, the highest year ever. We've since gone up since then. But it's not like we're, scaling back dramatically, even if the so-called doomsday scenario comes into being. And the other thing is, unfortunately, from my point of view, it probably won't happen. Even if that trigger is set off, it doesn't come into effect till 2013. Oh. So there'll be all of 2012 for Congress to revisit this, to fight over this, for the industry to lobby about this, for the president to be pressed about whether he's weak on defense and so forth. So the possibility of that whole $600 billion being cut is probably... Well, certainly unlikely, it's probably fairly low. So they're kind of taking a worst-case scenario and using it to basically bludgeon us over the head and say, well, we really shouldn't cut any more. Sort of a two-part play. One is, oh, we've cut so much already, which should not happen. And the other is, there's such a big cut on the horizon, which is not likely to happen.
Right, okay. The super committee, what power does that have? What is that process of making all this happen?
Well, you know, they've been empowered with crafting this plan, but of course they have to consult with congressional leadership to some degree, and also the president. It's simply because they're going to come up with a plan that Congress is supposed to vote up or down as a package. If they want it passed, they need to check with some of the important political players. You know, they can't just do it in a vacuum. But they do have, you know, so they have quite a bit of power to set the parameters for this next round of the budget debate.
Okay. Now, in terms of cuts, I'm sure you've got your list of what could be cut. What's the comparison between what they have shown and revealed compared to what you've done, and where do you think they need to go with it?
Well, one of the interesting things is these big numbers that they're scaring us with. They have no plan as to how they would implement those cuts. They're just hoping to keep them from happening. I was part of a group called the Sustainable Defense Task Force, and we were Representative Barney Frank, a progressive from Massachusetts, encouraged us to do a report that could be used to influence the President's Deficit Commission, the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which reported last December. And so we decided to target $1 trillion over 10 years, which coincidentally is the number that's being discussed now. And we would do things like reduce the number of U.S. troops overseas, make sure Afghanistan winds down promptly, not build as many new combat airplanes, the F-35, which is called the Joint Strike Fighter. They want to build 2,500 of those things, when in fact current generation of planes are more than adequate and, you know, superior to any possible adversary. We would scale down the size of the Navy, maybe have one fewer or two fewer aircraft carriers, which themselves cost, you know, $10 billion each, not to mention all the ships that have to protect them. We would scale back nuclear weapons. You know, we have nuclear overkill, which is quite costly to maintain. And a number of other things. So basically, fewer troops, fewer weapon systems, and fewer commitments, you know, not promising to go anywhere, do anything, fight on every possible inch of turf on the globe, which has not really been discussed or debated in the run-up to the presidential debate or, you know, in this debate over the budget. The assumption seems to be the Pentagon should be able to do anything, and so therefore we need whatever it takes to support that
to make that happen.
Capability.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing in terms of with all those cuts and all those changes and just how the world has changed militarily. The military has to change to reflect those the reality. Is it changing, or is it really looking at reality, or is it still stuck in the Second World War mode? What's happening with them like that?
It seems to be. It's almost like doing an archaeological dig. I mean, you know, they never give up anything. So they've got sort of, you know, World War II style ships, and they've got Cold War style weapons. And then they'll add things. So now they're spending a lot of money on cybersecurity, which probably makes sense. And, of course, they're very actively using unmanned aerial vehicles, armed drones that they've used to assassinate various you know, political military opponents. And so in that sense, you know, cybersecurity and the kind of the drone robotic kind of track is new, might have some applications to things like fighting terrorism. So it's not completely the charts in terms of its, you know, possible use. Whereas you have things like the F-22 fighter plane, which was built only recently stopped by the President and Congress. They cost, you know, $300 million each, and they've never been used. In Iraq, they were used in Afghanistan, they were used in Libya. And in fact, for most of the last year, they haven't been able to fly them at all because there's a problem with getting oxygen to the pilot, which is an important concern if you're going to fly the thing. So they have programs like that, which have, you know, don't even make sense in terms of fighting wars, and then they have some things which kind of they're relevant to fighting war. I think they're going to be overused. This notion that, well, you can just kill people at a distance and you don't have to put our pilots at risk, and you know, I think that's going to become a very tempting you know, move, as it has been already for President Obama, and I think eventually there'll be backlash from that. And I think it may also get kind of make it harder for the government to think through its options. If it's just easy to pull the trigger on a drone instead of figuring out a diplomatic solution, kind of regional economic development, a human rights policy, if suddenly, you know, drones are your kind of answer to dealing with terrorism, then I think there's, you know, that's a serious problem. But you know, in a very narrow sense, you know, yes, they're applicable to the problem of terrorism, unlike some of these other things, which really are just relics of past conflicts and past strategies.
All politics are local, and, you know, all the weapons, I presume, I don't know how many weapons are outsourced now to other countries, but presumably a lot of our weaponry is made in America. And do you track between the companies and the politicians in the areas that these are made? How do you look at those things?
Well, a lot of times I have to do it sort of to play defense against the propaganda of the industry. So whenever they build something, they say, well, it's going to create tens or hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's going to create them in 47 states and, you know, 400 congressional districts. And they sort of build up this notion that, you know, everybody's getting a piece of this thing, so there's no way to stop it. And it's certainly true that the industry spreads its work around as much as it can to curry political favor, but they tend to overstate that. So when we were fighting the F-22, they claimed about two or three times as many jobs created as actually were created by the plane. And they claimed that they were in 44 states. And yet, many of the senators from those states voted against them. So clearly, it was not an overriding economic presence in those states. So it's a serious problem, but it's also important to be skeptical of the claims of the industry, because they'll make it sound like, you know, if they've got some guy with a pencil in Utah, they're going to say the whole Utah economy depends on, you know, military spending.
Right.
But it's, yeah, I try to keep track of the, you know, where the things are built and the campaign contributions to the key members and sort of how all that plays out.
Yeah, because that obviously following the money always tells a lot, a good story.
I just did a piece on the super committee and contributions from weapons contractors. And the 12 members got a little over $1 million from the industry in the last two election cycles. And there's also former staffers of super committee members who are lobbyists for Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Boeing and Raytheon. There's 22 former super committee staffers lobbying for the arms industry. So the industry has its leverage there, in addition to whatever public campaigning it does, you know, against cutting the Pentagon budget.
Now, lobbyists, how is it still done, you know, the free martini lunch thing? You know, how is that done? Is it just sit down in just private meetings? How has that worked in Washington?
Well, I think it's a little less ostentatious than it used to be. You know, it used to be like they'd go out to some hunting lodge in, you know, the Maryland shore and spend the weekend together, and you know, some of them would engage in illicit activities of various sorts. Now I think it's a little kind of cleaner, you know, but it's still, you know, obviously the goal is the same. So, you know, and there's limits on, you know, gifts to members of Congress and where you can interact. But, you know, a lot of it can happen in the congressman's office, can happen over a meal, can happen at a reception. And, you know, the main point being that the lobbyists represent companies that, you know, A, are contributing to these members' campaign funds, and B, often have jobs in their states. You know, so the lobbyist already has his foot in the door by virtue of those interests that the member has. And then they also, I mean, a lot of it can happen at the staff level, you know, just former staffers going back, talking to their colleagues, trying to soften them up for this or that initiative. Mm. And when it works right for the industry, you get examples like right after 9/11, Boeing had Senator Ted Stevens, the late Ted Stevens of Alaska, yeah, put in a provision in the Pentagon budget saying you must lease 100 aerial refueling planes from Boeing. You can't get them anywhere else. You got to get them from Boeing. Mm. You have to lease them instead of buy them, and it's going to cost $26 billion. And so, you know, they had curried favor with Stevens. They had run special fundraisers for him. And, you know, he basically delivered for them because this was not, this didn't work its way through the normal process. It wasn't vetted by any committees. It wasn't part of the Pentagon proposal to Congress. It was just this one senator saying, you know, I'm going to help out this company because they've helped me. Okay. Yeah, so that's kind of the most blatant case. And in this case, as it unfolded, some people actually were convicted of criminal behavior and had to go to jail, which is very unusual in these cases. But there was a woman who was a procurement officer in the Pentagon, a woman named Darlene Druyan, who was got Boeing to employ several of her relatives and was also negotiating with them about how big a salary she would get while she was still in the Pentagon, supposedly driving a hard bargain with them over the cost of this plane. So because Senator John McCain got agitated about this, he subpoenaed all kinds of emails. And,
yeah,
and basically the story was there in black and white. There was no way for them to deny it. So Druyan did some time in jail, as did a Boeing executive. But, you know, what we don't know is how often do similar things happen, just not quite on that plate to scale. Because you know that, yeah, there are, we know there's hundreds and hundreds of people who go from the Congress and from the executive branch to work for these companies every
right
year. And so how many of them are thinking, well, gee, if I want to get a good job, I better, you know, lighten up on these folks. So even if it's not explicit, you know, the process, I think, might be similar.
Yeah, they position themselves, yeah. Now, of course, now with the change that corporations are people now, have you seen a big change since that was in came in?
Well, I think the, you know, the arms industry always had kind of a leg up in this lobbying business. They don't actually spend as much in campaign contributions as, say, the pharmaceutical industry or the banking industry. But they do employ a lot of lobbyists. A lot of people have come through the revolving door from government to work with them. They've got the jobs argument that they can use. You know, if you vote against jobs in your district, you're not going to get reelected. Therefore, you must, you know, support our weapon system. And then they've got the kind of wrap yourself in the flag argument, where they're involved in all kinds of you know, sort of propaganda activities in concert with, you know, their allies in Congress to kind of promote this idea that, you know, if we cut one dime from the military, our way of life is at risk. Mm-hmm. And probably the biggest proponent of that point of view is Congressman Buck McKeon, who's head of the Armed Services Committee. And he's from Southern California. His biggest contributors are Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman. He's got top secret Lockheed Research Facility in his district. His district is where the drones are built that are used in Afghanistan, Yemen, and so forth. He is sort of the ultimate kind of special interest politician, but he kind of wraps it in this, you know, kind of, you know, mom and apple pie wrapping.
Yeah.
And he's been getting away with it so far.
Interesting. So really, I mean, with all the devolving of companies, how many arms, you know, weapons companies are we talking about, the real big players in this country?
There, up until the 90s, there were maybe 20 or 30 large weapons contractors. And then there was a merger boom that was pressed by the President Martin Marietta, Norman Augustine, and he helped engineer the creation of the Lockheed Martin Corporation, which was a combination of about 18 different companies. And the U.S. government helped subsidize these mergers with our tax money. And basically the end result was where you had 20 or 30 big companies then, you have about five now. You know, you have Boeing, you have Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon. And they get about 20% of what the Pentagon gives out every year. So they're really the big players. Nobody else really is close.
Interesting. That's, not much competition now, in other words.
No, if you want to buy a fighter plane, you know, your choice is Boeing or Lockheed Martin. And the new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is a Lockheed Martin product. It's going to be used by the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, the UK is going to use it for its armed forces, nine other countries that have bought into it. So at that point, you're going to have one company to go to for fighter planes, and then it's going to mean that the government has absolutely no bargaining power. But on the bright side, you know, I do think that this budget crunch is going to force people to look more critically at this. I mean, you know, just as the Wall Street movement has kind of awakened people's concerns about inequality and sometimes criminal activities of the banking system, and just the fact that the majority of Americans are not getting a fair deal out of our current economic and political realities. I think in the military sphere and the national security, military budget sphere, that you could start to see a little bit of a awakening, a little more skeptical kind of approach by people, much the way that Eisenhower hoped when he gave his military-industrial complex speech. He basically said the only way to stop the complex was to have an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. And that's what's been missing in recent years. And so the question is whether we can kind of build on this new critical sense in the country to get people to think about some of these issues in the same way.
Excellent. I like that sentiment. We hope.
Now, well, hope is important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what else? But now, yeah, you talked about the world in general. Obviously, we make a lot of weapons that we actually sell abroad. And we've also got a lot of military bases abroad as well. How much do we spend on our military abroad, and how much do we sell in terms of weaponry?
The military abroad is a tough question because there's a lot of shuttling back and forth of troops, of equipment, and so forth. But I would think, you know, it's certainly quarter to a third of the budget, which would be $100-150 billion a year. And that includes, you know, 700 military bases and, you know, 12 aircraft carrier task forces that are on patrol, you know, pretty much 24 hours a day, ballistic missile submarines all over the globe and so forth. So it's quite a big operation, and no other country has anything like it. No other country aspires to cover the globe with its military the way the United States does. And then in parallel to that, you've got this big arms export machine. And the United States is the biggest arms exporting country, accounting for anywhere from a third to a half of all global sales in any given year. And it's the same players that are making the money. It's the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings. Boeing was part of a record size deal with Saudi Arabia last year, $60 billion for the deal to sell fighter planes and attack helicopters and bombs and guns and pretty much anything you could imagine other than, you know, selling them nuclear weapons, you know, is in that package. And there's never been a deal like that, I mean, you know, even close to it. But this is becoming the trend. You know, sales have quadrupled since the early 2000s, you know, U.S. arms exports. So it's been, you know, even as the Pentagon's been the growth market for these companies, the global arms trade has been even more of a market in terms of its rate of growth.
But of course, I don't know if you have statistics that show, you know, how much countries spend on their military and armaments, and how much war, you know, how much war there is. I don't know if there's a correlation there.
Well, there was a colleague of mine who used to work at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which has since been eliminated as a result of the work of Jesse Helms, the late right-wing senator from North Carolina. It's been folded into the State Department. It's much less active in disarmament-related issues than it used to be. But anyway, my colleague had done a study of arms transfers in Africa, and he did find that there was a correlation between the levels of arms sales and the incidence of conflict. Certainly there's a lot of other factors.
Yeah.
There's economic factors, there's long-standing political conflicts, there's a legacy of colonialism. But sort of simple factor is if people have a gun ready and available, they're more likely to use violence more widely and with less chance of sort of breathing space for political solutions.
Right. Going from small to large, obviously the nuclear, you mentioned that we're reducing our nuclear arsenal, and I heard, was it yesterday, they're just breaking down some of the big 9-megaton bombs, but are they going for a whole new improved, bright and shiny nuclear arms force?
Well, they're not building any new bombs at the moment, but they're kind of pushing the edges. They have these things called life extension programs, which is kind of an ironic name for something that's going to improve a nuclear weapon. But the notion is they're going to kind of refurbish these things for the cost of billions of dollars. But as they're doing that, they're tinkering with them, they're changing the capabilities, the accuracy, the explosive power, and so forth. So, it's almost like building a new weapon, but it's not under that name. And then they're pouring huge amounts of money into building new nuclear weapons factories for plutonium production and uranium production, and to make the non-nuclear parts that go into a warhead. And they want to build brand new set of facilities that will be ready to roll for 50, 100 years. So it runs very contrary to this notion that we're supposed to be getting rid of these things. If you're going to build an infrastructure where you can build them for the foreseeable future beyond.
Exactly. And one of my big things is energy conservation, energy usage. I know the military spends a huge amount on fuel and energy. Are they doing anything on that side of things to cut back?
Well, it's kind of interesting. They are spending money because if they look at a conflict like Iraq or Afghanistan, it costs them huge amounts of money to truck fuel around. And also, a lot of the casualties are related to fuel convoys and supply trains and so on. So they've been talking about things like solar-powered tents and, alternative fuels for aircraft. And, they seem to have some actual interest in alternative energy, but it kind of pales in comparison with just the huge size of the military, the fact that when push comes to shove, they want to do things quickly. They don't want to do them in an environmentally friendly way. So I think they're kind of chipping at the edges of the problem, but I think there's a kind of a contradiction between their mission as a killing force that's supposed to be going anywhere on short notice and this idea of an alternative approach to energy.
Now, what are you working on now? You got a new book you're working on or anything interesting?
Well, I just finished an epilogue that will be in the paperback version of my book, Prophets of War, about the Lockheed Martin Corporation. So the paperback's coming out next year. And then I've been considering maybe doing some sort of book on drones. Where do they come from historically, and what's the technology, what are the moral issues involved, which is something that seems to get all too little discussion in our media. What does it mean for the future of warfare? what kind of fights is it going to cause inside the military between the, the fighter pilots and the drone jockeys and so forth. So there's been a lot of good writing on this, and so I just need to make sure that I can add something to the conversation. And there's also a lot of new activism, people, doing civil disobedience at drone bases. It's almost a kind of the glimmers of what we saw in the nuclear disarmament movement, and it's starting with the people engaged in direct action. Many of the same communities that were involved in, doing civil disobedience against nuclear bombs are now turning their attention to the issue of drones. You know, I'm going to do a little preliminary research and then see if I have it in me,
Yeah.
Or if I should pass the project on to somebody else.
Oh, okay. Do you have a number of things you keep in your head at any time and then, one drops down? Or how do you work that? Do you just work on one thing normally?
I feel sort of constrained if I'm only working on one thing. there was a period when the New START Arms Reduction Treaty was in consideration in the Senate. I spent a lot of time writing about that. But the arguments were pretty clear. And so it didn't take a lot of intellectual heavy lifting to realize we should have fewer nuclear weapons and not more. But there were all kinds of bizarre arguments being made by the other side, which had to be addressed. 6-8 weeks of doing media around the country and, radio and some television and speaking to bookstores. And that was a lot of fun. I mean, at a certain point, you do feel like what I imagine a political candidate would feel like. I mean, you feel like you've given the same speech one too many times, but it's a big enough subject that you can kind of, throw the ideas up in the air and talk about it in a different way rather than doing the same routine every night.
Well, now, looking ahead, you must have a dream of how you would like to see where this country is positioned, say, in 10 years' time. How do you see that, just projecting if... things go as we see them and major wars get reduced. What do you see?
Well, I'd sort of like the country to age gracefully. we're kind of an aging empire. And, rather than go down shooting, why not take another look at the world and say we can work in partnership with other countries. We can put a better foot forward than just being the biggest military power in the world. And that, that we can contribute to diplomatic solutions to conflicts. We can develop new ideas, new products, invest a lot of these resources that were had been wasted on the military in more productive things. And I think part of that is probably somehow getting people to let go of this idea that we have to be number one at everything. Because I think that myth really stands in the way of doing a lot of useful and productive things. And certainly it ties directly into the issue of militarism.
Yes. There's a lot of work to be done, but you're doing it. You're giving us information that that we desperately need and bringing it out to... so we can make those judgments.
Well, I'm doing my best. These are hard issues to grapple with sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks a lot.